This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. After months of interviews and discussions, the 10 members of the Iraq Study Group sit down here in Washington today to debate a draft report on strategies for Iraq. Unconfirmed leaks suggest the group may recommend aggressive regional diplomacy that would include openings to Syria and Iran, which the Bush administration may find hard to accept. That diplomacy on Iran might be tied to regional issues in the context of a wider international meeting on the Middle East, and that there is still disagreement on the idea of a timetable for withdrawal of American and allied troops. No specific timetable might be hard for some Democrats to accept. And there's a host of other issues. What are the benchmarks for success in Iraq? Should the U.S. keep military bases in the country? Does the Iraqi constitution go far enough to guarantee the rights of Sunnis? Should it be renegotiated? Should the country be divided along ethnic and sectarian lines? The Iraq Study Group debates all this for 2 days and maybe more if consensus can't be reached. Its report is expected sometime in December. The group is headed by James Baker, former Secretary of State and longtime advisor to the first President Bush, and by Lee Hamilton, the former Democratic congressman from Indiana, who was also co-chair of the 9/11 Commission. And while the study group's recommendations aren't binding, proposals from an independent, bipartisan group could offer an approach that both parties might accept. So, where are the areas of agreement and disagreement? What issues do you think this group ought to focus on over the next couple of days? Three former foreign policy advisors from different administrations join us to tell us what they think. Later on in the program, the Talk of the Nation opinion page and the little bit of Michael Richards inside us all. But first, what should the Iraq Study Group be debating? What are the likely areas of disagreement? Our number in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. Dan Garay was director of the Office of Strategic Competitiveness. First, he had to learn how to pronounce that word in the Defense Department in the first Bush administration. He's now vice president of the Lexington Institute, a public policy research group based in Arlington, Virginia, and he's here with us in Studio 3A. Dan, nice to see you again.
Thank you.
As the Iraq Study Group meets today and tomorrow, what do you think the biggest point of disagreement is going to be?
I think it's clearly going to be on the military options or military questions in general. One of the weaknesses of the group is that it lacks really sufficient expertise on military matters. It is a political group. It has diplomatic
a lot of foreign policy experience.
But none on the military side, which if you think about it is rather odd considering that the military issues are key, including an assessment of the situation on the ground in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Yet we keep hearing from military people that the solution to this is going to be political.
Well, political, certainly within Iraq, where, frankly, again, this group has very little expertise in things Iraqi. There is nobody on there who's an expert on Iraqi culture, Arab culture, religion, the divide between Sunni and Shia. They have foreign policy and diplomatic experience, and then a great deal of experience in U.S. policy.
Mm-hmm. And that is seemingly where all of this comes down. A lot of people are looking forward to this panel as some sort of political cover that both sides can use to say, look, we may not agree with all of this, but for the purposes of comedy and a bipartisan agreement, let's go ahead.
That's right. In which case, at least if the leaks are any indication, and not just the leaks, Jim Baker's been on every TV show you can name, including The Daily Show, selling, if you will, the answers. It's not going to give us the answers. It's not going to provide the kind of cover. It's not going to answer the two basic questions. How do you stay in or how do you get out? It's going to do everything but that.
This idea of aggressive regional diplomacy, of including the neighboring countries, and the controversial part there is two countries on the State Department list of state sponsors of terrorism, Iran and Syria.
Look, you can certainly talk to them. You can talk to anybody, and that's a separate issue which people have argued over. The real question is not can you talk to them, it's what's their price for helping? What is Syria's price? Well, we already know part of the price. It wants an end to the investigation of the Hariri murder. It wants
In Lebanon.
It wants its position in Lebanon back again. It wants essentially the Golan Heights back. It has a long list. Iran, similarly. It wants things that we're not likely to want to give it independent of the situation in Iraq. So the question is the situation in Iraq so bad that this group would not simply say, let's have diplomatic openings to these countries, but advocate essentially that they be part of the solution and that we pay the price that they're going to ask, mm-hmm. I doubt that Jim Baker will go out on that limb.
Mm-hmm. Yet, as everybody points out, these countries can and in some respects have been difficult for us to handle inside Iraq.
Absolutely.
They could be extremely helpful if they chose to be.
If we pay the price. It's not a matter if they chose to be, as if Assad wakes up in one morning, or Ahmadinejad, and simply says, you know, I've been totally wrong about the United States and its role in the Middle East. They're going to want, if we're going to take a realistic view, mm-hmm. Hard gains for this gift they're going to give us. And there are very few of the gains they want that we're willing to give. But even if we gave it to them, a nuclear weapons program for Iran, Syria in control of Lebanon, that wouldn't come back to bite us again within a very short period of time.
Mm-hmm. If you were a member of this group, if you were in that meeting today, what questions would you be asking?
I would be asking, frankly, I would have asked of the military advisors, mm-hmm. Is there a military option? Are there things which, if done over a period of 2, 3, let's even say 5 years, let's go out to the extreme here, could in fact turn this around, or at least leave the situation such that the Iraqis could manage their country? That's the first one. Second one would be, is the Maliki government capable of, in fact, running Iraq? The third question I would ask is, if not, because that seems to be the crux question, if we cannot even rely on that weak reed, what alternatives do we have within Iraq? Can you partition it, or is that just another word for civil war? If it's a civil war, should we get out? It's sort of taken as an article of faith in all the commentary that if it's a civil war, we should just walk away.
Mm-hmm.
We've been in civil wars before. Other countries have. You can argue that Britain spent 30 years in Northern Ireland in what was a religious civil war,
mm-hmm.
stayed, and basically is in a fairly good place, although if reports in the paper the other day, not totally out of the woods yet. So is it worth our international prestige? Is it worth the future of the Middle East? Is it worth stability in the oil market, whatever you want to say, for us to stay even if it turns into civil war? If the committee could answer that question, what's it worth to stay? What's it worth to go? And play those two things out so then we can make a decision as a people. That would be a huge benefit.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can get some listeners involved in the conversation. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And let's turn to Bill. Bill's with us from Driggs in Idaho. Hello, Bill, you there? One last time. Bill in Idaho, are you there? And I guess he's not. Let's go instead to Chuck. Chuck's with us from San Francisco.
Hi. Thanks very much.
Sure.
The one thing I hope we don't have to hear too much more of is this, let's make the Iraqis take responsibility for their government. Because it seems to me that's just blaming the victim. Because, you know, we go in there, we deconstruct their government and their whole society and pretty much establish a system where chaos reigns. And then we say, well, you know, why don't you irresponsible slackers take responsibility? I'm sure they would love to take responsibility. The question is, how do we enable them to take responsibility? And it seems to me that training troops is not going to do it if we just train up a bunch of Shiites who seem to be the majority, because it just seems like a recipe for a Sunni insurgency, which seems like a perfect opportunity for al-Qaeda to really get established and as part of that Sunni insurgency, which seems to me to be a disaster. So as you said earlier, seems like it's going to have to be a political solution. So how do we enable that to take place?
And is that an element of new thinking? The Bush administration, Dan Gray, had said all along, as soon as they stand up, we can stand down.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is there was an old solution. The old colonial solution was pick one side and say, you're now in charge. That's exactly how essentially the Iraqi government of old came into power, because the British did that.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with the Alawites in Syria. That's how the Assads, if you will, wend their way into power.
Tamils in Sri Lanka, too, and that's not worked out so well.
And not worked out so well. So the problem you have here is, of course, that the Sunnis don't particularly want to play in the governments or feel that they're not going to get a fair shake, and it's hard to guarantee them one. The Shia say, we're the majority. We ought to be the majority of the military, the majority of everything else. And we're the, you know, in effect, stuck in the middle. We have said all the right things. We know what the steps are, if you will, balancing this, providing that, sharing the oil, governance. It's a matter of trying to get it done. And ultimately, you know, since it is a majority Shia nation, the Shia and the Kurds, if they go together, like 80%, if they choose at the end of the day, down the road, a different way of approaching their ethnic division, that may be certainly the time for the U.S. to step aside or even get out.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Chuck, thanks very much. A question about American military bases for the future in Iraq. Should the United States be willing to tell the Iraqi people at this point, look, we're leaving, and when we're out, we're out?
Certainly, at the end of the day, that's the thing we should be saying. You know, we don't need bases in Iraq for military purposes. We have them elsewhere. The question really is, how do you say that without putting yourself on a short leash if you think you may have to be there in support of the Iraqis for, let's say, a decade?
Mm-hmm.
There's another one of those timeline problems. Can you set a timeline for departure from all bases? And the answer is no. Can you say no permanent bases? Yes, one could say that. And it's a little baffling why the administration hasn't simply said, look, we have no territorial designs. There will be no permanent bases, even if, frankly, once you build the PX and the swimming pool, it kind of looks permanent.
Finally, Dan Garay, we just have a few seconds with you left. As this report nears, do you think that this is going to be a pivotal moment, in at least for the last 2 years of the Bush administration?
No, what I'm really concerned about is that it's going to be pablum. It's going to be air, really, because we've seen all the easy things. And on the difficult questions, I think the commission either won't step up to the plate and make a statement or will make a wishy-washy statement on the one hand, on the other hand.
Mm. Dan Garay, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Dan Garay is vice president of the Lexington Institute, a public policy research organization based in Arlington, Virginia, and used to work in the first Bush administration. I'm not going to try to pronounce that office again. He joined us here in Studio 3A. When we come back from a short break, Richard Haass, a former director of policy planning for the State Department, and later Nancy Soderbergh, who served as ambassador to the United Nations, will join us as we continue to discuss the deliberations of the Iraq Study Group. What do you think they ought to be debating over these next 2 days here in Washington, D.C.? I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back after the break. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Coming up on Wednesday at this time, our guest will be I. King Jordan, the outgoing president at Gallaudet University. This will be the first time he's spoken with the media since protests shut down the school last month. We'll provide real-time captioning of the conversation for the deaf community. And on Thursday of this week, Murray Horowitz returns with some of the best holiday movies of all time. You can email your favorite holiday classic to us at talk@npr.org and then join us Thursday on Talk of the Nation. Today we're talking about the Iraq Study Group, the issues they may agree on and where they may disagree on U.S. policy. We've gathered three former foreign policy advisors to tell us what they think. And, of course, you're invited to join the conversation. What should this group be debating over these next 2 days? Where are likely areas of disagreement? Give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. Joining us now from New York is Richard Haass, who was director of policy planning for the State Department. Excuse me. I apologize. Just a frog in the throat. Richard Haass served as director of policy planning in the State Department and also served as special assistant to the first President Bush and was senior director for Near East and South Asian Affairs at the National Security Council, now president of the Council on Foreign Relations. And nice to have you back on the program today.
Thank you, Neil.
He joins us on a good line there from the Council studios in New York. Your assessment, where are the likely areas of disagreement as this Iraq study group settles down to debate its draft report?
The likely areas of disagreement will probably deal with the details of military reductions. That's become in some ways the hottest, most symbolic and divisive issue. And I would be surprised if there were a consensus saying you ought to reduce by a certain amount by a certain date. I don't think you're going to get anything that specific.
This is the timetable for withdrawal, and a lot of people in the Democratic Party would say, wait a minute, there was an election here, we won, you guys lost, and this should be reflected.
With all due respect to those who would argue that, what you mainly had at the polls, I believe, was not so much advocacy of an alternative policy, so much as an expression of unhappiness with existing policy. So I think it's a bit much to interpret what happened a few Tuesdays back as a clear support for any particular policy orientation.
Mm-hmm. So something new is what people were asking for. What do you think will be new in this proposal?
Probably two things. One is so-called diplomatic engagement. I think you'll have some sort of a call for a regional meeting, possibly or preferably a standing regional forum that would involve all of Iraq's immediate neighbors, including the two controversial states of Iran and Syria, as well as other outsiders who have a legitimate stake in things. I think that's probably going to be the single most significant policy recommendation or offering of the study group. And secondly, I think you will have an emphasis to some extent on reductions, more likely on a reorientation of the U.S. presence to essentially reduce the warfighting role of the American military and to increase the emphasis on advising, that is sending American soldiers as advisors with Iraqi units, and also obviously to continue the emphasis on training. So it'll add up to essentially our doing some things differently and to our doing less in Iraq militarily, certainly putting less American troops in harm's way. That will be the recommendation. And again, a large emphasis on adding a diplomatic dimension to U.S. policy.
But along the lines of the proposals been made and debated for some time now, splitting the country along ethnic and sectarian lines into roughly three big units, new thinking like that you don't think is going to be part of this?
No, I don't think that's going to happen. If you're talking about dividing Iraq into three separate countries, I would say that most experts who have looked at it think that would make a bad situation worse. That would become a recipe not just for civil war but for regional war. There's not a lot of enthusiasm for that.
But there's sort of a federalized structure, even more
sure.
federalized than the one they've got now.
Right. I was going to get to that. The federal idea put forward by Senator Biden and my predecessor, Les Gelb, here at the Council, that idea of what you might call federalism on steroids, a greatly decentralized Iraq, heavy autonomy and so forth with power sharing and revenue sharing, I think a lot of us agree that that's a good idea. The problem is you can't get Iraqis to agree to it. Indeed, if you could get Iraqis to agree to that idea, then you wouldn't have a lot of the problems you now have. So it's you know, ideas don't have to simply be desirable. They also have to be feasible and viable. And my concern is that you simply don't have a consensus in Iraq on the details of decentralization and on the sharing of power and money.
Yeah, and it's fine for a blue ribbon panel in Washington to say, you know, they ought to renegotiate their constitution. It's another thing to actually go ahead and make them do it.
I just don't think you can come up with a particular package, how would I put it, that would be enough for the Sunnis and that wouldn't be at the same time too much for either the Kurds or the Shia. There simply isn't a culture or a history or a tradition of compromise and sharing. And indeed, you know, as several people have pointed out, in order for democracy to work, you first have to have Democrats with a small d. And in Iraq, you simply don't have that tradition to build on.
Let's get a caller in. Now, this is Ali. Ali with us from Alexandria, Virginia.
Hey, Neil, first-time caller. And I'm actually I am an Arab American. I do understand the culture. I think one thing that we are not talking about is the Iraqis in general, they don't like America. They don't like Westerns, no matter, you know, what side are. And I think the solution is, what they should be talking about is how they can get the American out of there and then send someone else, could be United Nations, the Muslim community, whatever nation, to get in there and then clean up whatever happened, and that put these people together and try to come up with a solution.
And do you anticipate anything like that coming out, Richard Haass?
The short answer is no. The sorts of losses and cost that the United States has incurred in Iraq and the lack of progress to show for it has discouraged any other country or organization from following suit. So we're simply not going to get other countries queuing up to volunteer, and we're not going to get the United Nations willing to take on Iraq as some sort of a modern-day trusteeship or protectorate. It's not that Iraq wouldn't benefit from it. Of course it would, because it clearly can't govern itself. You simply don't have either the capacity or the will in the international community to take on this burden.
Ali, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Okay.
Bye-bye. As you look at, I mean, people have described the options in Iraq as a series of all bad options, and the idea of arriving at a solution by this independent panel would be to give both political parties some cover here to accept some things that might not be acceptable to them. For example, the question of Iraq and Syria, opening talks with them, with the administration is not going to be happy about that.
Let's take a step back, Neil. I think words like solution, victory, and success, alas, need to be expunged from our Iraq-related vocabulary. We're simply not going to achieve anything at that level. We're really talking about how do we best limit the costs, how do we best limit the damage of what's proven to be an expensive, by every definition of the word, foreign policy adventure for the United States. And there's one other part to this calculation. In addition to limiting the costs in Iraq, I think the question arises of what can the United States usefully do to help promote U.S. interests beyond Iraq in order to offset some of the loss, in order to demonstrate that the United States can still be effective in that part of the world and beyond. And it seems to me, and this is probably beyond the writ of what Mr. Baker and Hamilton are going to suggest, but that suggests to me such things as a new diplomatic initiative vis-a-vis North Korea, a new diplomatic initiative vis-a-vis Iran, something between Israel and Syria. Those look to me to be the diplomatic opportunities that could perhaps offset some of what I think is the unavoidable loss that is Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Yet there has been talk of putting this in the wider context of Middle Eastern issues, saying you can't look at Iraq separately from the Israeli-Palestinian, Israeli-Arab situation, and indeed not of Lebanon either.
Well, there's a difference. There's those who think you need to widen it and to bring in these other issues in order to improve the situation in Iraq. I'm not suggesting that. No amount of progress between Israelis and Palestinians or between the various parties of the Lebanon civil strife, no amount of progress in those other venues is going to get the people in Iraq, the militia members, to lay down their guns. What I'm essentially saying is something different, that Iraq is going to turn out badly. It is turning out badly, but there are things we can and should do elsewhere in the region and beyond that would potentially bring about gains for American diplomacy. They wouldn't necessarily improve the situation in Iraq, but Iraq, at the end of the day, is not the entire chessboard for American foreign policy.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email question from Gabe in Napa, California. Could your guest please comment on the actual extent of a possible withdrawal with the largest embassy complex in the world and several military bases being built by the U.S. in Iraq? It seems to me that any talk of withdrawal is essentially meaningless. We seem to be planning on being in Iraq on a near-permanent basis no matter what.
The word withdrawal is a big word, and I think more likely for the foreseeable future is clearly reductions. But what matters is the details. At the end of the day, what is the size of the U.S. presence? Where is it? What does it do? What is the context? All of those factors matter a lot more. And I think I agree with an earlier statement I heard. We probably should not be in Iraq in terms of permanent bases. That should not be the way we are thinking. We should increasingly get out, I believe, of the center of Baghdad, get out of the center of the fighting. And we should look more to adopt what you might call an indirect role, more in support of an Iraqi government, so long as, and I'd say this clearly, so long as there is an Iraqi government to support. My concern, and I think it's everyone's concern, is that we're not that far off from where essentially there being no serious national authority to support. And if and when that day comes about, then there really isn't a serious military role for the United States in Iraq.
Richard Haass, thanks very much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, Neil.
Richard Haass served in the administrations of President Clinton and the first President Bush. He's now president of the Council on Foreign Relations and joined us today from their offices in New York. With us now from Jacksonville, Florida, is Nancy Soderbergh. She served as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations and was Deputy Assistant to the President for National Security Affairs in the Clinton administration, now a visiting distinguished scholar at the University of North Florida in Jacksonville. And it's nice to have you back on the program today.
My pleasure.
And I wonder, given the bipartisan nature of the Iraq Study Group, do you see any big areas of disagreement looming?
Not within the group itself. These are centrist, both Republicans and Democrats, but primarily realist centrists. And I think it's pretty clear what they're going to recommend. They'll have a series of benchmarks for political progress, following which American troops can begin to draw down, but not a timetable. They'll have a kind of Dayton-like, Bosnia-like internal conference to try and have the Sunnis feel more empowered and hopefully reduce their insurgency. And then there'll be some kind of regional involvement. You can bet that Jim Baker is on the phone with his old friends, the Saudis, as well, to try and have them come up with some kind of useful effort. And I think that's pretty much where this is coming out by the end of the year. The more controversial areas, is President Bush going to accept it, and is Congress going to accept it?
And I guess the devil for them will lie in the details. For President Bush, would the make-or-break issue be opening diplomatic relations with Iran and Syria?
I think the make-or-break issue for the president is giving up total control of this policy at all. They have had very little discussion in the country and with the Congress about this, and I think the fact that his father's advisors are coming back to try and fix his problems rubs the wrong way with a lot of these people, and they're going to be resisting accepting this wholeheartedly. Bush has started his own national security review, his own Pentagon review, and he'll cherry-pick some things to show his independence from there. The democratically controlled Congress, I think it actually will be less in the details than the fact that they will not recommend strong reductions in and fast, quick reductions in troop numbers, which is what the majority of the party now in control of the Congress is pushing for.
We're talking about the deliberations of the Iraq Study Group. Our guest is Nancy Soderbergh. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get a caller in. This is Michael. Michael with us from Napa, California.
Yes, thanks. I was wondering why the study group can't begin by admitting that the real reason why we're in Iraq is the control of the world's strategic oil reserves. That's why we're there in the first place. And then with that honesty that both the rest of the world and all of America know that that's why we're there, then begin to confront the issues of, well, now that we're there and everybody knows why we're there, how to deal with the situation, whether or not to stay with it or let it go, which, of course, is not going to happen, which is why the troops are not going to leave indefinitely. So how could we get them to be truthful and address the oil card?
Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Do you think they already have? Jim Baker was famous in the first Gulf War in 1991. When asked that question, he said the reason that we are in Iraq today, that being 1991, was OIL, oil. He said it very bluntly and plainly, and I think it's been very clear that we're this.
And that was 15 years ago, and I haven't heard a word of it in months.
Well, I think that saying it would probably be helpful, but I don't think it would solve any problem. Everyone knows that if this conflict were happening in the middle of Africa, we would not have invaded. So I think it's partly oil, is partly the strategic area, and I think, you know, most people would recognize at this stage that the war was probably not an imminent threat, not necessary, and one that has been mishandled from the start. So they have a lot to be honest about, and there I think the Democratic Congress will help begin to bring out a little bit more honesty and frank discussion with the administration.
And because it cuts right to the chase as far as troop reduction or bases staying, I mean, if we're there for that, and everybody knows we're there for that, then you absolutely know it's a given that our troops are not going to leave that strategic area, period.
Well, they won't leave before there's some semblance of stability that they can hand the job over to, and that's probably a couple of years away. But I do not think that 10, 15, 20 years from now, we will still be occupying Iraq, regardless of its oil or not. Mm. We will not stay in Iraq a day longer than we need to.
Michael, thanks very much.
Oil
is the elephant in the room internally as well. I mean, if the group is going to recommend changes to the internal arrangements inside Iraq, which were certainly grandfathered by the United States, oil is going to be the big factor in terms of providing Sunnis enough of a share of it.
Well, and that's one of the main problems with the proposal by Biden and Gelb that you were just speaking about with Richard Haass, in that how do you decide to divide the oil revenue up among the various regions? Do you have it a federally controlled oil regime or a regionally controlled oil regime? What do you do about the oil-rich area of Kirkuk that's been fighting between the Kurds and the Arabs? I mean, none of these are easy questions. Which is why my guess is you'll have more or less the central government with some local control, but not formal autonomy in these regions.
And yet a lot of people say, we just have a few seconds before we have to go to a break, but unless you renegotiate that arrangement on oil and economics and inside Iraq, you're not going to give enough to the Sunnis to abandon their insurgency.
Well, it's not even just the issue of oil that the Sunnis have gone to an insurgency, civil war, whatever one chooses to call it. These are individuals who have been favored for decades by the British as well as by Saddam Hussein, who actually believed that they were a majority, if not 80% of the country. And it's a very hard thing for them to recognize that they're only 20%, and the majority of the country are the Shias and not they.
Nancy Soderbergh, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there for a couple of minutes. We'll be back after a short break. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. We'll also be going to our opinion page. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. In a few minutes, the Talk of the Nation opinion page, but let's wrap up our conversation about the pending report from the Iraq Study Group. Still with us, Nancy Soderbergh, former Deputy Assistant to the President for National Security Affairs in the Clinton administration, now at the University of North Florida in Jacksonville. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And this is Audrey. Audrey with us from Jackson, Wyoming.
Hi.
Hi.
I was wondering how the general public can have so much faith in this round of experts when we've been asked to have faith and believe the opinions of so many experts in the past on this war, and it doesn't seem to have panned out. So I just sense the country is putting so much hope into this group of people that they're going to get us out. And I've just been disappointed throughout the years reading the paper and listening to people give their opinions that supposedly have so much expertise on the subject.
Nancy Soderbergh, an awful lot awaiting the outcome of these deliberations, but it's binding on neither Congress nor on the administration.
No, and I think part of the problem that Audrey's been having is shared by a lot of people in this country, and that the administration has not been straightforward with us about the cost of Iraq, what the challenges are, and what's been going on. We were sold that this would be an easy, quick war, welcomed with flowers. That turned out not to be the case. We did not expect to be there so long or at such a great cost to American blood and treasure. What the reason this panel of bipartisan respected individuals is expected to, quote, solve the problem is that these are individuals who don't have a particular beef one way or the other with this administration. They're viewed as being fair and honest about what they really think. They've got vast amounts of experience between them, and most importantly, they are not viewed as ideological the way most of the individuals who have run this war, the Cheneys, the Rumsfelds, the Rices, and President Bush himself, they do not have that ideological blinders on them. So there's a lot of hope that this will offer a way forward. Now, it's important to remember that there are no easy answers in Iraq, and there is no magic wand. This will be a path forward that will still be difficult, messy, awkward. There are no good options in Iraq. Whatever you think of the decision to go to war, the way it has been handled since we got there has made the job very much more difficult, and there just simply are no good options. So no one should be under any illusions that even if every recommendation were adopted by this group, that our job is going to get a whole lot easier or the troops are coming home a whole lot faster.
I wonder, just to follow up on Audrey's question, is this group diverse enough? You were describing it as largely Democratic and Republican centrists and realists. Is this group diverse enough to produce a real, you know, option? There is no advocate of out now, no powerful advocate of that in this group. There's no powerful advocate of saying we ought to be sending more troops now to stabilize the situation.
Well, I think if you'd had a too broad a group, you would have a series of recommendations coming forward that were somewhat contradictory. You'd have option A, option B, option C. That is not what the Congress was looking for. What they chose is not individuals for the diversity, but rather their breadth of experience in these types of tough issues. And I think that's what they were looking for. I'm sure the president is bristling a little bit that so many of his father's former advisors are part of it because of the image that the father's coming to save the son's neck on this. And I think that's the only kind of awkward part of it. The Congress is the one that is going to play the withdrawal faster card, and the U.S. Executive branch, the president on down, will be the ones who resist any change in their current policies. So I think you will see a very vibrant debate coming out of that, but the most realistic path being put forward by this very respected group that will make either the left or the right wing's job harder if they want to try and reject these recommendations.
Audrey, thanks very much for the call.
Wow, thanks for your answer. I appreciate it.
Okay, bye-bye. One final follow-up on that. As you look at, the makeup of this group, and we heard this earlier from Dan Garay, who was on the program, no specialists in Iraq, no specialists in the Arab world, no specialists in the Sunni-Shia divide, no military specialists. This is a group of American foreign policy experts.
Well, they have drawn on any number of experts who know the Shias, the Kurds, the region, the Syrians, the Iranians. What you're looking for is individuals, and it's men and women, who have a vast amount of experience in how to deal with very difficult issues. So I think it's a group that is bringing a lot to the table. The Congress has decided to do it this way. The president has asked his own individuals in the National Security Council and the Pentagon to do their own review, so you'll get the military's input, you'll get the Iraqi experts from the National Security Council's input into that. And what you're going to see is a very lively debate when this issue is put forward, this report is put forward at the end of the year. Starting in January, you'll have a lively debate from the McCains that we need more troops, from the Murthas that we need to get out now, from the administration that doesn't want to push too hard on some of these benchmarks and tighten the reins that they've had pretty much free rein on over the last 6 years on the administration and the last three in Iraq. They're not going to like that kind of control. They're not used to anything but absolute power, and that's about to change for them well. So it's going to get very interesting.
Nancy Soderberg, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Nancy Soderberg, former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations and Deputy Assistant to the President for National Security Affairs in the Clinton administration, now a visiting distinguished scholar at the University of North Florida, and she spoke to us today from her office there. When we come back, it's the Opinion Page.